Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. If we as Americans honestly look at how our government operates, regardless of whether you're a Democrat or Republican, conservative or liberal, I think most of us can agree that Washington and our federal government doesn't work the way it once did and the way most of us believe it's supposed to. We may tolerate it more or less depending on whether the presidency or congressional majority follows our own political inclinations. But most of us think that Washington is broken. My guest today says, yes, indeed it is, and that over the past 60 years, presidential power has increased exponentially to our detriment. Congressional power has diminished through self-inflicted action or inaction, also to our detriment. Money rules the complete process. Extreme partisanship affects the judiciary, the media, as well as the populace at large. Joseph Califano Jr. says it's up to us to change things. Califano spent more than 30 years in Washington, serving in a variety of pivotal roles, including in the Pentagon under Robert McNamara, in the Johnson White House, where the New York Times labeled him the Deputy President for Domestic Affairs, and later as U.S. Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare in the Carter administration. His new book is titled Our Damaged Democracy, We the People Must Act. It's published by Touchstone. Joseph Califano, it's a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, it's great to be there.
Yeah, many knowing your background in government might think that on reading the title, Our Damaged Democracy, Why the People Might Act, that this book is a reaction to maybe just the last couple of years or even maybe the last year or so of federal governance. But this book describes problems that go well back into your time in government in the 1960s and the 1970s. Why did you write this book now?
Well, I wrote this book because I've been watching what's happening with the Congress, with the presidency, with the courts, with our media, and I believe that there are systemic problems deep in these organizations that people have to understand. They're not attributable to any one president or any one Congress or any one court. For example, the presidency. There's been a colossal amassment of power in the presidency over the last 50 years. Presidents have sent millions of Americans into combat. 1 million have been wounded. 100,000 have died over that period. And there's been no declaration of war, a power that the Constitution gives to the Congress. Presidents are the chief legislators now. They issue 20 regulations for any law that Congress passes. So they're, and those violating those regulations can incur civil penalties or even criminal penalties in some cases. Presidents run a state-run media now with modern communications, and really greatly expanded in the Obama administration. We have WhiteHouse.gov. We have YouTube around the clock. We have the internet. We have interactive internet, all running 24 hours a day. And with President Trump, we've added tweeting and what have you. So we have this world, which is that kind of a state-run media is more typical of a monarchy or a dictatorship, not a democracy. That's the biggest communications operation
in
our nation.
Well, you describe this as sort of a creep, a mission creep, if you will, if we borrow the term from the military, is that over the, probably going back to, really the post-war era, but really in the 60s, I think you would say that this is where you started seeing the power of the executive grow, and it grew with every administration.
That's exactly right. It has just accumulated. And as that power has grown, you look at the Congress, in the book I call it the Cripple Congress. Congress has become crippled by some self-inflicted wounds. For example, gerrymandering. We have a situation now in which, with all the sophisticated data we can accumulate about neighborhoods and areas, you create districts in which the Republican is sure to be elected or the Democrat is sure to be elected. What happens? Well, the primary becomes the real election, and in the primary, the Republican Party, the guy on the right, Marco Rubio, said you're never going to be out-conservativized in a Republican primary. On the right, in the Democratic primary, the candidates are pushed to the left. And if they get elected, they've made all kinds of commitments on the fringe right or the fringe left. When they come to Congress, they won't compromise. They turn compromise into a four-letter word in Washington. And you have to compromise. We had to compromise in the Johnson years to pass all those great society programs, to get Republican support for them. But when they come from this gerrymandered world, their concern is always, well, who's gonna go after me in the next primary? Is he gonna be further right or further left than I am? I can't have a record in which I've given in on this. So I think gerrymandering is a very, very serious problem.
Well, let's talk a little bit about gerrymandering, if you will, because this seems to be an issue that, the federal courts have been very reluctant to step in on this. But it seems like, at this particular point, federal courts are beginning to look at gerrymandering as an issue that they can take on. How important is this in your mind?
I think it's very important. The Supreme Court now has the case in Wisconsin and the case in Maryland. Wisconsin involving Republicans, Maryland involving Democrats. I think it's very important. Go back to the days of Earl Warren when he was Chief Justice. He said, in all those years, the most important decision of the Supreme Court was the one man, one vote, one person, one vote, in which they ended the practice in which a rural vote could be the equivalent of several hundred urban votes. I think if the court will take on this gerrymandering issue, and I hope they do, we will stop devaluing the vote of our people. And it will be the most important decision of the court in the Roberts era, Roberts being the current Chief Justice. So to me, it's critical. And, we are devaluing the vote. I think we devalue the vote by giving money the power of free speech. We have a situation in which the first question somebody asks if they're going to run for office for the Congress or for a state legislature or governor, how can I raise the money? They used to ask, how can I do more for my district, or how can I make my city a better place, or how can I change the school, or how can I make the state more economically attractive? Now it's, how do I raise the money to run?
You describe the money house that's involved in being a member of Congress now. I think members of Congress, former members of Congress, have described this quite accurately of how much of their time now within their very short legislative week is spent raising money. Can you give us a sense of how much time that is?
Call time. It's called call time because you can't raise money on federal property. So you walk across the street, there's a Republican club and there's a Democratic club about 4 hours a day while they're in Washington and more when they're home. If you want to, the average cost of an incumbent senator running for re-election in 2016 required that he raise $30,000 a week every week of his six-year term. The average cost of a Republican election was required an incumbent to raise $15,000 a week every week of his two-year term. That's a problem. The money thing also drives another thing. There's a pay-to-play element in Congress now. You want to be chair of the House Ways and Means Committee or the Appropriations Committee or some other. You've got to raise money for the Congressional Campaign Committee. How much? There's a whole table as an appendix in this book. For Democrats, it's $500,000. You must raise $500,000. In addition to whatever money you raise for your own campaign, you must raise $500,000 for the general congressional campaigns. And for Republican, incidentally, it's $800,000. We have to change this. This devalues the vote of an American citizen.
Now, has that always been a part of Washington as far as...
Not to this extent. Sure, there's always been fundraising, but nothing like this.
President Johnson used to
we proposed public financing of election campaigns in the Johnson years. I wish we had come to some version of that. We haven't. I think we have to. We can't, because also we didn't have. We have another thing now that is new, the sort of the billionaire world. If you're a billionaire, and you can say, you say to somebody, you know, it's created this single issue world. I only care about what you think about abortion. You're pro-choice or pro-life or guns. Are you pro-gun or anti-gun? What are you saying on the climate? If you follow exactly what I, the billionaire, believe should be done, and just say it, I'll give you enough money to run for office. And if you're elected to the Senate, of course you got to stay with that, or the House. And if you're running for the, if you're in the presidential primary world, you stay with that. You repeat it at every debate. So we have got to, you know, we have got to remember that this is a democracy, and our democracy is damaged by all of these things.
But getting back to the pay-to-play
right.
item, in the old days, you know, you accumulated a committeeship chairmanship, which gave you a lot of power and a lot of ability to wield pork back to your district or to your state through seniority. Are you saying now that it's really a matter of how much money you can raise,
as opposed to
knowledge of the issue of that you're of the area you're chairmaning?
Absolutely, and it's and the committees with the most power, the defense committees, the Appropriations Committee, the House Ways and Means Committee, which presides over taxes and banks and Medicare, for example, you have to raise more than with a committee like the Agriculture Committee. And you can look in the appendix to my book. That's 2013. Every member of the Democratic Congress is listed in that appendix, and how much money they had to raise. And you'll see that the committee chairs have to raise significant amounts more.
Now,
the same thing is true of Republicans.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't get my hands on a Republican chart like
you have
that.
Your sources are better Democratic than Republican.
Well,
you've served in Democratic administrations.
And
my guest today is Joseph Califano Jr. He served 30 years in Washington at the Pentagon, on the Johnson White House staff, and later as Secretary of Health of Education and Welfare, as we called it then, in the Carter administration. He's the author of Our Damaged Democracy, We the People Must Act. It's published by Touchstone. And he talks about all the major institutions of Washington and how virtually all of them are broke and how it's going to be up to us to figure out ways to fix it. If I can go back to the presidency, you really talk about the accumulation of power in the presidency. You earlier alluded to the fact that as commander-in-chief, the president is basically circumvented Congress. And in fact, every conflict we've entered in which Congress has passed a resolution, there's been a signing statement that the president has put, and this is both presidents, Republican and Democratic, that have said, I'm signing this statement, but as condition of signing this, I believe that the power of the presidency gives me the power to act unilaterally in this conflict. This really, and this goes across a whole range of presidential actions, executive orders and signing statements, which are basically they're saying that the presidency really is the well above the first among equals. It's the priority branch of government.
Yes, they're saying they're the towering branch. Absolutely. They are king of the mountain, king of the political mountain in Washington and in the United States. And it is every single president. Ronald Reagan, one of the examples I think I use in the book, he signed an environmental law and he said to parts of it he wasn't going to follow. Every president has done that, and particularly, I would bet that if you questioned a wide variety of people under 30, they don't know that the Constitution gives exclusive power to the Congress to declare war, and the Congress has just sat back and let it happen. That's the incredible thing. They let it happen because it's not only crippled, there's a cowardly element. They don't want to get on record. If you think about the, and that happens, incidentally, the Senate has basically turned over its treaty power to the president. 98% of the agreements these presidents have reached over these years have been called executive agreements, so the Senate doesn't have to have a two-thirds vote to approve a treaty. And if you look at the agreement that President Obama made with on Iran, the Democrats in the Congress pretzeled themselves in order to avoid having to vote either way on that. I mean, that's not what the Senate should be doing. And, you know, and basically I'm saying, you know, we the people have got to tell the Congress, we want you to do your job. We didn't elect you to raise money. We didn't elect you to avoid your responsibilities. We elected you to do your job.
Well, now let me ask you, you have that section about treaties. A lot of that is, I would think it is executive reaction to the fact that Congress doesn't like to approve treaties. You know, either party doesn't like to approve treaties. And most of the time when a treaty comes before Congress, it's a hugely contentious bill that comes before the Senate for approval. And a lot of times we can't get to two-thirds majority.
That's right. I understand that. I understand what you're saying, Rich, but I would like to say that is a commentary on the Senate and the members of the Senate. They would rather be in a position to say, I didn't have to vote for or against this. The president did this. There are some things in it I like, but some things I don't. I mean, when I say cowardly, I mean it. They're not only crippled, they're cowardly in that respect particularly. They'd rather not have to vote on it. And that's one of the reasons why the president has been able to enter into these combat, I say in the book, Congress is the only place where war isn't a war, in the world. And you know, you think about that, and, you know, if you want to meddle with our system like the Russians do, you say, boy, this system is cracking. The system is so weak. There's so many people that don't have any courage anymore. We can play games with them.
Well, one of the other things I found really interesting about this book was, you know, we think of Congress as growing. In fact, the congressional staffs have been contracting for a couple of decades. And what's been growing has been the size of the executive. When you look at, you contrast when you were in the White House in the 60s to where we are today, the size of the White House staff and the executive staff has ballooned, I think, a couple thousand times.
Yes. We had a staff of about 50 in the Johnson years. The White House staff now is approaching 2,000. For example, the NSC staff under Kennedy and Johnson was probably about 15 people. It's over 400 people today. The communications to run the state-run media and the communications operation is hundreds of people. I had a domestic policy staff of four. It's now about 130, 150. And what does that do? It overwhelms the cabinet. And, you know, this is not a Trump problem or an Obama problem. This has just happened with everybody. Overwhelms the cabinet. It also creates a situation in which a lot of, you know, pesky issues get to the president that really shouldn't. He should be focusing on big strategic issues. But when you have a staff that large, they bring more and more issues to you. And lastly, the chief of staff in the White House is the most powerful person in Washington next to the president. Overwhelms any cabinet officer. It's hard to remember the names of any cabinet officer today. But yeah. We all know General Kelly is the chief of staff.
That's true. And you really do an interesting job of helping normal people understand how the White House staff overwhelms the cabinet. in which you have, for example, the State Department. The NSC makes a lot of, the National Security Council makes a lot of the decisions that we would normally think would be a State Department decision, in which the, I think you've described as the last two Secretary of States have basically been globetrotters and just meeting with various governments. A lot of the on-the-ground decision-making has not been the State Department. It's been the White House's national security staff.
Yes, sir. Just think about a couple of things. In the Obama administration, the whole negotiations with Cuba were done by the National Council's NSA staff in the White House. Hmm. I don't think Kerry even was informed about it in the Secretary of State. The decision to make Jerusalem the capital, to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, was made in the National Security Council in Trump's administration. You're absolutely right about that, and it's true. I mean, you know, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and John Kerry logged what? Both of them well over a million miles in their 4 years. They lived on their airplanes, bouncing from one international meeting to another while the NSC staff delivered policy and controlled it.
Mm. Now, you know, what's the drawback of that situation in your mind?
Well, one, for the president, the advantage is my NSC staff doesn't have to be confirmed by the Congress. The Congress can't get them to testify. They're on the White House staff. And we can do things in secrecy because we can impose, you know, we can claim executive privilege on all their work. They're advising the president. Secondly, it's very hard to get really talented people, not just as the Secretary of State, but for the Secretary of State to get talented assistant secretaries and the policy staff. It demeans the government department. And, you know, people, you ask some if they want to take a job, and they say, well, you know, if I'm going to end up just taking orders from somebody in the White House, no, I don't want to do that. It's very hard to get people to take those assistant secretaryships today.
My guest today is Joseph Califano, Jr. His new book is titled Our Damaged Democracy, We the People Must Act. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. He's served for 30 years in Washington at the Pentagon, in the White House, in the Johnson administration, and as the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare in the Carter administration, among other of things he's done over his long career. And he outlines the ways in which our government's damaged. We've been focusing on Congress and the presidency, but he also looks at the Supreme Court, media, all of the various establishments of the federal state, and a lot of what you're talking about, when you're talking about money and politics, it goes back to this huge partisanship that's a part of our country. And when we talk about solutions, your solutions seem to be it's about American people stepping up and demanding more leadership from congressional leadership and how we confirm judges and the like. But given this extreme partisanship, we're a divided people. How do we actually...
We are divided people. There's no question about that at the current time. And I think we have to find leaders, men and women who are willing to run for office. We have to demand candidates that will say, I'm going to make government work. Look, our people know Washington is broken. What I tried to do in this book is lay out exactly how it's broken in a way they'd understand it, because my firm belief that if our people understand what the problem is, we've always acted on it. It may have taken a little more time, but we acted on it. And I think acting on it, first and foremost, requires us to say we're not going to just look at the Democratic cable channel or the Republican cable channel. We're going to open our minds a little bit. We're going to talk to each other. You know, we have to talk to each other. And we have to have some trust. As I note in the book, trust is very, very important. If there is no trust, it's very difficult to get anything done. And the partisanship, the raw partisanship, has really undermined our trust. There's no trust between the Congress and the President. There's no trust in a local government in some local governments. We have a house in a town in Connecticut in which, sure, there are Republicans and Democrats, but they all manage to come together on the city council staff eventually on these issues. They talk them through. We don't talk to each other in Washington. You know, these guys and gals, they come in on Tuesday morning. They're there Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, leave on Thursday afternoon, and they go either home or to towns where they can raise money. You know, they don't go back to Tulsa. And they go to New York, they go to Chicago, they go to Atlanta, they go to Dallas, they go to Houston, they go to Los Angeles. You know, as Willie Horton said, why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is, and that's where these candidates and incumbents go, where the money is. It also affects the way they think about their own constituents, because they're so indebted in a soft, what I call soft corruption. They think about, what does this person that just gave me $50,000 think about this issue? And their committees are so important. What committee they sit on in terms of their raising money, that they often tend to tilt more towards the people they're regulating, whether it's the truckers or whether it's the banks or whether it's the energy companies, than what their constituents would want.
Because that's where the money is to keep them in their chairmanship or their on that committee.
Exactly right.
Well, in our last minute or so, what would be the biggest takeaway that you would like to see changed maybe a first step?
All right, first step, everybody votes in primaries. And, you know, if you look at the presidential election, Hillary Clinton got the Democratic nomination with 8% of the registered Democrats. Trump got the Republican nomination with 7% of registered Republicans. And you hear people say, oh, my God, what a choice we had. We had, you know, we had a woman who felt entitled and really didn't have a program, and we had a guy who was kind of an egomaniac. Well, you left it to the last minute. Get involved in the primary. Get involved in the primary for your congressman, the primary of your town council, the primary of your state legislator, the primary of your governor, the primary of your senator. Get involved in the primaries. And I think, secondly, listen to some television shows or radios, shows you may not agree with. An American can look at night to news that's going to tell them what they want to hear. I think that some of these cable channels view your viewers as citizens. They view their viewers as customers. Hmm. What does the customer want? We'll serve it up.
The name of the book is Our Damaged Democracy. Joseph Califano, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Rich. I'm enjoying it.
Joseph Califano is the author of Our Damaged Democracy, We the People Must Act. It's published by Touchstone. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.